Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. With the confirmation hearing underway for a new Chief Justice of the United States, John G. Roberts is in the thick of it today as members of the Senate Judiciary Committee begin their questioning. In their opening statements yesterday, the 18 senators set the tone for what's to come, but it was really Judge Roberts' skillfully grasped moment in the spotlight and couching his message in a baseball metaphor that carried the day. Here's what he said.
If I am confirmed, I will confront every case with an open mind. I will fully and fairly analyze the legal arguments that are presented. I will be open to the considered views of my colleagues on the bench. And I will decide every case based on the record, according to the rule of law, without fear or favor, to the best of my ability. And I will remember that it's my job to call balls and strikes and not to pitch or bat.
Chief Justice as umpire, according to John Roberts. But this is an umpire with vast power. With day two, the questioning has begun. So far, the nominee with the face of Mr. Nice Guy and the poetic images of baseball and Indiana cornfields is on a roll. But the issues, abortion rights, voting rights, sexual discrimination, presidential power, environmental protection, and more, are as big as they get. The Roberts hearing is underway in Washington. On today's show, we'll listen in with our own Supreme Court analysts. You can join the conversation. Are you rooting for the president's clean-cut candidate? Are you worried about Roberts, the lawyer who wrote of the so-called right to privacy and the perceived problem of gender discrimination? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me from Minneapolis is Patrick Schiltz, professor and founding dean of the University of St. Thomas College of Law in St. Paul. He's a personal acquaintance of John Roberts and keeping one eye on the hearings even as we speak. Patrick Schiltz, thanks for joining us.
Nice to be on with you, Tom.
And with us again from Washington is Jonathan Turley, professor of law at Georgetown University. Jonathan Turley, wonderful to have you with us.
Good morning, Tom.
Just a week ago, we were looking at the demise of Chief Justice Rehnquist and back on the Rehnquist era. Now we have the hearings underway. Arlen Specter kicked it off, chairman of the Judiciary Committee, and he got right into the thick of things. I want to hear what you two think of just the first 30 minutes of this questioning. Let's get just a little bit of that. Here is Arlen Specter, Republican maverick, chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, asking John Roberts about Roe v. Wade.
Well, do you see any erosion of precedent as to Roe?
Well, again, I think I should stay away from discussions of particular issues that are likely to come before the court again. And in the area of abortion, there are cases on the court's docket, of course. It is an issue that does come before the court. So while I'm happy to talk about stare decisis and the importance of precedent, I don't think I should get into the application of those principles in a particular area.
Well, Judge Roberts, I don't know that we're dealing with any specific issue. If when you mention, and you brought the term up, erosion of precedent, whether...
And there it is, the interrogation of Judge John Roberts underway just in this last half hour or so in Washington on Capitol Hill. Jonathan Turley, a lot already in the first half hour. Arlen Specter went at a big litany, and he started right off with Roe v. Wade. We heard John Roberts say it's settled as precedent of the court. Yes. Have we heard the nominee this morning already say that he will stand by Roe v. Wade, or is that just a layman's too broad interpretation?
No, far from it. I actually read John Roberts in completely the opposite way. First of all, the Specter leading with this question makes sense. You know, trial lawyers often take the view if you've got tough questions, you raise it with your witness on direct before the bad guys get them on cross.
Okay.
And Congress probably follows the same rule. But Specter, I think, does feel strongly about Roe v. Wade. I think that was clear when he held up over 30 a display with over 30 cases to say, boy, isn't this really settled law? John Roberts has said nothing in response. He's basically said, I'm not going to answer a question as to Roe. I accept stare decisis. I accept you shouldn't overturn precedent lightly, that it's a jolt to the system. All of that is really saying nothing at all. That is very standard language from 1,000 different cases, and none of it would even indicate that he how he feels on Roe v. Wade.
Patrick Schultz, do you share that view? Is this just eyewash or bland generalities, again, to the untutored ear, when Arlen Specter and John Roberts say, look, this has been reviewed in a number of cases, Roe v. Wade, Casey? John Roberts comes back and says it's settled as precedent in the court and indicates that he respects settled precedent, that is stare decisis, I guess the Latin term here. Does that mean to you that it's still a wide-open field for him to do whatever he likes, or has he said something substantive?
Well, I wouldn't say it's a wide-open field, but I would agree with Jonathan. I think any lawyer in the country would answer the question exactly, or would agree that A, Roe versus Wade is settled precedent, and B, the court should be very careful or reluctant to overturn settled precedent. I don't think John Roberts is saying anything that anybody else nominated to the Supreme Court would say. The question is whether he's going to say anything further than that. Senator Specter, one of his colleagues yesterday, I think it maybe was Senator Graham, said, if you're looking for consistency, this isn't the place to come for it. Senator Specter is actually someone who has been pretty consistent. He is very aggressive in questioning nominees. He has always expected them to get quite specific about what they would do as Supreme Court justices. He's certainly being consistent, and John Roberts is being consistent with the line that Justice Ginsburg and Justice Breyer and others before them took, which is not to come out and say one way or the other if they're in favor of overturning Roe versus Wade.
Jonathan Turley, just a week ago, with the death of Chief Justice Rehnquist, you were with us on the show along with Patrick Schultz. You described John Roberts as Bork without a beard. So, but we have to ask then, are you suggesting that John Roberts can say in these hearings today, I respect settled precedent, I respect stare decisis, I understand that there's settled precedent around Roe v. Wade, then become a Supreme Court Justice, Chief Justice, and move to overturn it anyway?
Oh, he certainly can. I mean, you can be in favor of stare decisis and overturn Roe. Roe is without question a settled precedent in that the court has declined repeatedly to overturn it and has in fact applied it. But the concept of stare decisis does not prevent the court from overturning doctrines. It requires the court to consider various factors, and it encourages the court to only overturn settled law when it is absolutely necessary. I believe, and you know, that we're all looking at the tea leaves here, that John Roberts is going to dramatically narrow Roe. I think that there's a case on the docket this coming term dealing with parental notice. I think he'll rule with the right wing of the court. By the way, I happen to agree with the view on parental notice with the right wing.
Mm-hmm.
But I also believe that he will continue to narrow or possibly overturn Roe. I mean, what you're seeing today is one of the best appellate lawyers in the country, and he has already refused not just to answer questions about Roe, but even a hypothetical put to him by Leahy. He's saying that he won't even answer hypotheticals that could come up in some form before him as a Chief Justice. That means that these hearings are going to be very likely a series of judicial sound bites. You know, I believe in stare decisis. I don't overturn precedent lightly. Those types of sound bites, which will not in any way bind him for the future.
Patrick Leahy, the Democrat, ranking Democrat on the Judiciary Committee, questioning John Roberts right now on Capitol Hill. They've been talking about presidential powers, presidential war powers. Let's listen in.
I don't agree with that. The president instead went ahead and nominated Mr. Bybee to a federal judgeship.
Well, Youngstown's a very important case in a number of respects.
We're into the weeds there a little bit, but the question that Leahy jumped in with, Patrick Schultz, was about congressional power to stop a president pursuing an unauthorized war. I don't know if you got to overhear what John Roberts had to say in response, but he did not seem quick to lift the congressional power up at the expense of the president.
Yeah, I think one of the concerns about Roberts on the Democratic side is that he would be unduly deferential to the president based upon some of his prior work. And I was struck yesterday during the opening statements by how large a role the question of institutional power played, how much power Congress should have vis-a-vis the president and vis-a-vis the court. And I don't remember another Supreme Court hearing in modern times where the issue of institutional power was as prominent as it was yesterday. So I expect this is the first of many questions you're going to hear along these lines.
If I could jump in.
Jonathan Turley, yes.
Patrick is absolutely right on that. What I thought was amazing is that all of these senators, including Chairman Specter and Grassley, were wailing on the Supreme Court for overturning prior federal statutes. And it was perfectly bizarre, because the people that overturned those statutes were the right wing of the court. When they're talking about we want justices who would do that, they'd have to look to people like John Paul Stevens and Ginsburg.
They're railing against it because they've taken it as an insult to Congress.
Right, but those conservative justices, people like Scalia that they adore, and Rehnquist and Thomas, were voting to overturn these statutes because they violated federalism, the guarantee of states' rights.
Mm.
And one of the statutes they referred to, you know, gun-free school zones case,
yes,
was a facial violation of states' rights. In my view, it was almost absurd for Congress to have passed that law. But it really was sort of discombobulating to hear Republican senators demanding that Roberts be like the left wing of the court.
Exactly what this nominee is not likely to be, and the conservative appointees before him. We'll go out with some of the sound from Capitol Hill. Jonathan Turley, Patrick Schilt, stand by. We're talking about John Roberts before the Senate. Here he is responding again to Patrick Leahy. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
The president is the commander-in-chief, and that meant something to the founders. On the other hand, as you just quoted, Congress has the authority to issue regulations governing the armed forces, another express provision in the Constitution. Those two can conflict if by regulating, making regulations for the armed forces, Congress does something that interferes with, in the president's view, his command authority. And in some cases, those disputes will...
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about John Roberts before the Senate and the search for the soul of the country's likely next Chief Justice. You can join the conversation. Is it a done deal? Is there no stopping John Roberts? And should the nominee to be next Chief Justice be an open book? Will he be? We can all begin to judge that yesterday and today. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined in this hour by Jonathan Turley, law professor at George Washington University, and from Minneapolis by Patrick Schilt, professor at University of St. Thomas College of Law in Minneapolis. Judge Roberts has been getting a little grilling, first with Arlen Specter, now with Patrick Leahy, ranking Democrat on the committee. Let's hear his new question.
Do you interpret the Bill of Rights the same, whether we're in wartime or not?
I do, Senator. I read the Chief's book that you quoted from. For someone who sits on the court that I sit on now, we famously look back to one of the first cases decided in the D.C. Circuit. It was the Aaron Burr trial. And it's, if anything,
I thought
the motto.
You might mention that.
Well, it's sort of the motto of our court, an opinion that was written out of that, in which the judge explained that it was our obligation to calmly poise the scales of justice in dangerous times as well as calm times. That's a paraphrase. But the phrase calmly poise the scales of justice is, if anything, the motto of the court on which I now sit. And that would be the guiding principle for me, whether I'm back on that court or a different one, because some factors may be different, the issues may be different, the demands may be different, but the Bill of Rights remains the same, and the obligation of the court to protect those basic liberties in times of peace and in times of war, in times of stress and in times of calm, that doesn't change.
I hope you
Judge Roberts there responding to Patrick Leahy. Jonathan Turley, Patrick Schilt, Patrick Leahy has gone very vigorously in the last few minutes on powers, war powers. He asked John Roberts straight ahead, does Congress have the power to stop a war? And Roberts' response was, Congress certainly has the power of the purse. Leahy responded, the power of the purse? We've cut off money and the wars keep going. And repeated the question, can Congress stop a war. Jonathan Turley, John Roberts seems to be not real clear on that in responding to the senator.
Well, Tom, if you're looking for clarity in these hearings, it's going to be a very long day for you.
I'm just a curious citizen. He's just my Chief Justice one day, perhaps.
Yes, well, you know, John Roberts has a number of past documents that indicate that he has a very deferential view of presidential power. They include memorandum when he was a government attorney that indeed one of those memos was raised by Senator Leahy. The memo suggested that he did not believe that Congress could effectively require a president to pull troops out of the field. And then also he signed on to a national security case not that long ago, which took the position of the administration on the Geneva Convention and to some extent presidential powers. The expectation from people like myself is that he will be a highly deferential justice to the administration. But this is one of those areas where he is just not going to answer a question. He is doing what good lawyers do. He's eating the time. One of the things you tell witnesses before Congress is that when the other side asks you a question, you talk slow and you talk long. When your side asks a question, you talk short, and that's what he's doing. When Leahy's asking him questions about a memo, he's going back to Youngstown cases and the Aaron Burr cases
right.
and holding forth.
Right, right. Patrick Shields, what about what we can justly expect in these hearings? I mean, Patrick Leahy, senator from Vermont, Democrat, asks what sounds like a pretty straightforward and important question. Should the Bill of Rights be sustained even in wartime? John Roberts sounds very reassuring in his response that the court should calmly poise the scales of justice. That sounds very reasonable, but it's not a straight-ahead answer by any mean. Are we not even entitled to that kind of answer that seems so fundamental?
Well, on the one hand, everybody there would agree that Senator Leahy asked John Roberts, you know, next term in Smith versus Jones, how are you going to vote? He shouldn't answer that question. And everybody agrees that it's okay to ask John Roberts, you know, how as a general matter he would approach the issue of overruling precedent. The hard questions are the in-between ones where, you know, Senator Specter, for example, says, I won't ask you if you'll vote to overturn Roe versus Wade. I'll just ask you if you think there's a constitutional right to privacy, you know, if there's a right to privacy in the Constitution and how you would apply that right to privacy, which sounds a lot like asking whether you'd overturn Roe versus Wade. And Senator Specter, I thought, hit it right on the head yesterday when he said, nominees answer about as many questions as they think they need to answer to be confirmed. And if you go through the recent hearings, you'll see that the nominees that had pretty smooth sailing didn't answer a lot of questions. Justice Scalia, who I helped prepare for his hearings, said almost nothing specific. And those who were in some trouble, like Clarence Thomas and Robert Bork, answered a lot of questions. In Roberts' case, you're more of an expert on politics than I am, but it appears that he's probably got fairly smooth sailing. I think he's going to run into trouble when they start getting to his prior writings. It's very hard for a nominee to say, I won't explain to you what I meant in this document you have sitting in front of you.
They're talking about his prior writing right now. Patrick Leahy asking about, it looks like a sexual abuse case. Let's listen for a moment.
Discrimination been interfered with. You argued that she had no right to damages for this abuse. Now, your view was rejected by the Supreme Court. Justice White, an opinion joined by Justice O'Connor and others, wrote that you fundamentally misunderstood the long history of the court's role in providing appropriate remedy for such abuse, and that you had invited them to abdicate their historical judicial authority to award appropriate relief. So do you now personally agree with and accept as binding law the reasoning of Justice White's opinion in Franklin?
Well, it certainly is a precedent of the court that I would apply under principles of stare decisis. The government's position in that case, of course, in no way condoned the activities involved. The issue was an open one. The courts of appeals had ruled the same way that the government had argued before the Supreme Court. And it arose because we were dealing with an implied right of action. In other words, a right of action under the statute that courts have
talking here about the sexual abuse of a schoolgirl and how the government might intervene in response. I want to begin to take your calls. Jeff is calling from Salem, Massachusetts. Hi, Jeff. You're on the air.
Hi there. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Yeah.
I have just a quick question. Your guest earlier touched on the possibility of Roberts being indebted to the president, and I just wonder how you guys feel about that affecting his role in the future as Chief Justice.
You mean indebted because he's been nominated to be Chief Justice?
That's right.
Okay, we'll pick it up. Thanks for your call, Jeff. Patrick Schiltz, I suppose every nominee is indebted in the sense if they want to be on the court and a president puts them up for that position, that there's a kind of indebtedness there. How does that play into how they sit on the court?
It doesn't at all. I mean, I don't think there's ever been a justice who has not in some way disappointed the president who nominated her or him within the first term they were on the court, and I would expect John Roberts would fit in the same tradition.
Jonathan Turley, you've written looking forward about how John Roberts might evolve over decades, and he might well, at age, was it 50, 51 now, he might well have decades here. What kind of evolution are you anticipating when you put your kind of speculative futurologist hat on?
Well, you know, I was asked by the Village Voice in their edition coming out this week to look ahead and to see if there's anything we can do to predict where John Roberts is. And as you know, predictions have more often than not been wrong. We've had numerous cases of mistaken identity from Earl Warren, who was put on as a Republican nominee. After all, he was the Republican governor of California, became the virtual icon of the left. Brennan was the other nominee of Eisenhower, and he called both of them the two biggest mistakes he ever made. You know, there's a whole litany. I don't believe John Roberts is going to be like that. I think that he is going to be more like Rehnquist, Ginsburg, Scalia. He's someone who comes to the court with a well-thought-out judicial philosophy. He's not a politician who didn't think that deeply about where he fit in this whole spectrum. I think that he's going to continue the revolutions that Rehnquist started in the areas of takings and federalism. Remember, he could well beat the record of John Marshall.
For longevity on the bench.
Absolutely. And I think that he has the makings of what could be one of the great chief justices. He's young, which means he's going to be there a long time, and that certainly has an effect on the imprint a chief justice uses. He's going to have the first stable, reliable conservative majority on the court in decades, so he'll be able to refashion the law. And then finally, he's coming in at a time of some turmoil. And, you know, great dangers to a nation make for great decisions, and great decisions make for great justices. So he could prove to be one of the greats.
Yeah, I also, if I understand correctly, Jonathan Turley, I think you've also written that unlike William Rehnquist, he may not just wait for his fellow Supreme Court members' decisions, he may lobby.
Well, you know, I think that he is more likely to lobby than William Rehnquist. I think Rehnquist never really did try to do what Earl Warren did. Earl Warren was the ultimate deal-maker model of a chief justice. But I think that ultimately, John Roberts, when he looks at models of chief justices, he's more likely to look at someone like Charles Evans Hughes, who was the chief justice during the Roosevelt administration. And like Roberts, he was on a court that was in political transition, although Hughes was a transition from the right to the left, the opposite of what happened with Roberts. But at the end of the day, I got to tell you, I think he's going to be more like Chief Justice Rehnquist. I think that he's going to rely on an ideological voting bloc that's going to change the face of the law, because there's a host of 5-4 decisions out there which now could, and I think likely, many will be changed.
Let's turn to Pete calling from Iowa City, Iowa. Hi, Pete. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you? And thanks for my call.
Sure.
Or thanks for taking my call.
Yeah. What are you thinking?
Well, for one thing, I think that this continued ambiguity, in other words, not answering a specific question, is that's a big red flag right there. And also, Tom, I think the last statement that you just said about Judge Roberts not citing for an abused child, in other words, not being able to give this child compensation, is a giant red flag that gives an indication of where he will stand for the people, basically, like when they're faced with perhaps institutional abuse or large corporate abuse.
Pete, we're losing your phone line a bit, but I think you've got your antenna up about where his his heart may lie. Orrin Hatch is now questioning John Roberts, of course, Republican Orrin Hatch, and he's asked him about to describe how what he might be like as a Supreme Court jurist. Let's listen to John Roberts responding.
You being open to theirs. They, after all, are in the same position you're in. They've read the same briefs. They heard the same arguments. They've looked at the same cases. And if they're seeing things in a very different way, you need to be open to that and try to take another look at your view and make sure that you're on solid ground. Now, I think that general approach results in a modest approach to judging, which is good for the legal system as a whole. I don't think the courts should have a dominant role in society and addressing society's problems. It is their job to say what the law is. That's what Chief Justice Marshall said, of course, in Marbury versus Madison. And yes, there will be times when either the executive branch or the legislative branch exceeds the limits of their powers under the Constitution or transgresses one of the provisions of the Bill of Rights, and then it is emphatically the obligation of the courts to step up and say what the Constitution provides and to strike down either unconstitutional legislation or unconstitutional executive action. The court has to appreciate that the reason they have that authority is because they're interpreting the law. They're not making policy. And to the extent they go.
John Roberts there responding to Republican Senator Orrin Hatch, asking him to characterize what kind of judge he might be on the Supreme Court. He responded he would be a modest judge. And we hear him, hear Jonathan Turley kind of reprising the theme of his opening statement yesterday when John Roberts said he would serve as a kind of national umpire. I wish you'd think about that metaphor with us for a moment. What does it suggest when a Supreme Court justice sees him or herself as an umpire rather than a shaper of the nation?
Well, first of all, Tom, what you're seeing with Orrin Hatch, who is the one of the very best at these hearings, is that very often the White House will give senators questions or the senators will give questions in advance of the nominee. Their task is to give the nominee a breather by asking easy questions that he can hit over the fence. Questions, you know, like, you know, do you like the bald eagle more than other eagles?
And should we stick with red, white, and blue in the flag?
Exactly. And it gives the, it also allows the nominee in this case to talk in an unguarded way, so he leaves the impression that he's not being defensive to the American people, that he's being responsive. Now, in terms of his view of being an umpire, I think that, frankly, is very close to his philosophy. He has a narrow view of the role of the courts, and I think that the American people are going to see the effect of that. In the past, he has written in law review articles in favor of restricting access to the federal courts by citizen groups, environmentalists. He adopts a very deferential view to presidential power. He adopts a very robust view in terms of states' rights. All of those things tend to minimize the role of the Supreme Court in a way that goes against what many people assume to be their role. I mean, we've gotten used to looking to the Supreme Court to tell us what our rights are and to expand them or possibly shrink them. Roberts comes from a school that you shouldn't be looking to the court that much. We should not be in that role of running around on the bases. We're here just to sort of keep the other two branches in line.
And does that mean that he could, would oversee a kind of regression on those rights that have been articulated in the last 20, 30 years, Jonathan Turley?
Well, you know, I guess he wouldn't call it a regression, but I do believe that he is going to roll back on and continue the efforts of Rehnquist to roll back on some of these cases that increase the authority of the courts. Remember, he's going to be Rehnquist with the majority that Rehnquist always wanted and never really secured. And I think he is going to now realize Rehnquist's dream about narrowing the role of the court. And in some respects, yes, I think he will roll back on prior cases that gave the court a more active view.
Let's go out listening to Orrin Hatch on Roe v. Wade.
Just ask, am I correct that Casey reaffirmed the central holding in Roe, but substantially changed its framework?
That's what the joint opinion of the three justices said. It was reaffirming the central holding. It revisited and altered the framework.
But there were only a few votes to simply reaffirm Roe, weren't there, in the Casey case?
Well, the plurality opinion is regarded, I think, as the opinion of It's the opinion of the plurality, but as the leading opinion of the justices of the majority, it's the one that judges look to in the first instance. There were separate opinions that disagreed with some of the ways in which that plurality revisited Roe. It reaffirmed the central holding in Roe v. Wade. It dispensed with the trimester framework, and it substituted for the strict scrutiny that Roe had established the undue burden analysis that hence since the time of Casey has governed in this area.
Well, as I recall it, there were only a few votes, as you've mentioned, to simply reaffirm Roe. But this...
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com, and Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital, for more than 60 years helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services in Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about John Roberts before the Senate and the search for the soul of the country's very likely next Chief Justice. Orrin Hatch, Republican of Utah, is still on the Roe v. Wade front. Let's listen for a moment.
On any particular issue, you are not campaigning for elective office. The question that needs to be answered is how you view the role of unelected judges in a representative democracy. And I know you've said you do not... have what might be described as a carefully calibrated, highly defined judicial philosophy. But as each individual case comes before you with its own unique facts and issues, yesterday you gave us your commitment that you will approach that case within a certain framework. Now, I'm more interested in learning more about that framework, that perspective, and what you believe your job as a judge really is than I am in how you specifically implement that framework in specific cases or individual cases. Now, this is where I do differ with some of my colleagues. I want to know more about how you get or how you intend to get to a conclusion, while some appear to only want to know what the conclusion will be, like on issues such as abortion. Some think that judges exist to defend.
And John Roberts will no doubt come back with a theme very much along the lines of his opening statement yesterday, that he'll be balanced and careful and motherhood and apple pie, Patrick Schiltz. Another softball from Orrin Hatch here?
Well, it's like deja vu all over again. You notice that one thing that a lot of these questions don't have in them is actual question marks. They're more speeches by both on the Democratic and Republican side. They're more speeches that are designed to appeal to the base or to influence the next nominee than they are questions. You also notice the answers should remind you a lot of your high school civics class, which are lots of truisms about what the court said and what this opinion said and how many people voted that way, but never really anything there to get anybody excited about. And this is a par for the course in modern confirmation hearings.
But delivered with a winning earnestness from John Roberts. I want to ask you, though, about the exchange we heard just before the break, where clearly Orrin Hatch was pushing Roberts to say that the central holding of Roe v. Wade was upheld in the Casey case, but that there was a lot of change there as well. It seemed to me he was sort of digging for an acknowledgement that there was erosion of Roe v. Wade. Did you hear that, Patrick Schiltz?
Well, he's spinning, and again, I gathered Senator Hatch was mostly speaking through John Roberts, and he was speaking to John Roberts, and the message he was sending is that Roe versus Wade already has undergone some changes, and it hasn't brought the country to a halt, and therefore it shouldn't be a one-issue litmus test. And again, I took it that Hatch was really speaking more through Roberts than to Roberts in that particular question.
Jonathan Turley, we heard Roberts say earlier in this hour that he would be a modest judge, President Bush, that he would be a humble president. Does modesty itself have a political implication here or a kind of judicial philosophy embedded in it, even if Orrin Hatch is quoting him saying he doesn't have a carefully calibrated judicial philosophy?
Well, you know, saying that you're going to be a modest justice is a lot like saying that you're going to uphold good dental hygiene. I mean, the ultimate effect of being modest is not going to be great on actually what you do in your opinions. it does have a big difference on style. You know, one of the models of a Chief Justice is found with Warren Burger, who had an imperial style of Chief Justice. He was a very, frankly, pretentious Chief Justice and was widely disliked by his colleagues, including William Rehnquist, who, you know, there was one report of how Rehnquist actually would mock the Chief Justice with his clerks. On one occasion, the Washington Post said that Rehnquist and his clerks were laughing hysterically as they watched Warren Burger picking out the silverware for one of his formal events. And, you know, certainly I think Roberts is not going to be that model. He's going to be modest. He's going to be deferential. He's going to be respectful. I honestly believe that liberals will come to really like John Roberts for his personality and loathe him for his voting record.
That personality on display this morning on Capitol Hill. Mark is calling from Boston. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. My question is, do the guests believe that, and I do, that the argument for judicial activism versus restraint is a smokescreen, that one person's judicial restraint is another person's law, and that there is only an umpire, in the judge makes a decision? That if Roberts truly believed in stare decisis, he'd be still favoring separate but equal. And this was evidenced on the Supreme Court by the Bush versus Gore decision.
So it's set up as activism versus restraint, but you're saying is restraint itself an active philosophy? Patrick Shields, how do you respond?
Well, I would say this, that I think there are differences between judicial activism and judicial restraint, but I think what we're understanding, and Jonathan made this point earlier today, is it isn't a liberal and conservative difference. Certainly I agree that the words judicial activist and judicial restraint have been used by each side depending on whose gore or whose ox is being gored. But I think there are judges who are more deferential to the legislative and executive branches who have a more modest, and that's the way John Roberts is using the word modest. He's not talking about his personal qualities. He's talking about your reluctance to overturn decisions made by other lawmakers. And I think you have people who are genuinely more strong believers in judicial restraint than others, but it isn't a conservative-liberal issue. If the law at issue is a liberal law and you are deferring to Congress, that's a liberal result, not a conservative result.
Jonathan Turley, do you agree restraint is not political?
Well, you know, unfortunately, this is at a point of the rhetorical that it loses its legal significance. I mean, I do not believe that John Roberts is going to be understated in his voting records as he is in his personality. When he says, I'm going to be modest, I don't believe you're going to find John Roberts using the same type of fiery rhetoric of Scalia. He's not the type to go after his colleagues like Scalia does. But I do believe that he will have a voting record very much like Scalia's. Now, I have to tell you, by the way, I happen to like Scalia's opinions, even though I disagree with him, because this is a group of people that can be unbelievably dishonest. I mean, every one of them embraces stare decisis when it's to their advantage.
A group of people. Are you referring to conservative Supreme Court justices?
No, I'm talking to all the justices. Every one of these justices have written opinions that I consider to be just facially dishonest.
Dishonest? I'm not following what you mean. The opinions themselves are dishonest, meaning suggesting what? Why?
Well, to give you an example, when Rehnquist saved Miranda in the Dixon decision not long ago, it shocked many people because he had been long a critic of Miranda, the decision that gives suspects in arrest certain warnings.
Read them the rights, yep.
That's right. And what Rehnquist said was that we've never said that Miranda was not a constitutional rule and that this decision is perfectly consistent with our earlier rulings. Scalia went after the majority and in the first paragraph actually cited every one of the majority justices in prior cases questioning or outright denying that Miranda was a constitutional rule or principle. That is very common on this court in recent cases, this willingness to sort of reinvent history. And Scalia, I think, has been a good influence in that sense, in sort of calling his colleagues to the mat and saying, look, if you want to save Miranda, save Miranda, but don't pretend.
Straightforward. Let's listen to just a comment from just a few seconds ago from John Roberts asking about, he was asked whether he would legislate or interpret the law from the bench.
The people who framed our Constitution were jealous of their freedom and liberty. They would not have sat around and said, let's take all the hard issues and give them over to the judges. That would have been the furthest thing from their mind. Now, judges have to decide hard questions when they come up in the context of a particular case. That's their obligation. But they have to decide those questions according to the rule of law, not their own social preferences, not their policy views, not their personal preferences, according to the rule of law.
Justice Roberts, or Judge Roberts, perhaps not so long from now to be Justice, talking about that difference. Patrick Schiltz, often framed in terms of interpreting or legislating from the bench, clearly in the modesty vein, saying he doesn't want to be seen as legislating from the bench.
Right. The answer is always going to be interpreting from the bench. But, you know, to get to the point about whether that is a conservative or a liberal view, think of this through the lens of Bush versus Gore. And I expect some senator will ask John Roberts about Bush versus Gore, and Roberts talks a lot about how judges should stay out of controversies, how they should let the political process, even if messy, work. He just referred to the framers not wanting all the hard issues to be decided by courts, but letting the American people decide them through their elected representatives. I'll be curious to see what his answer on Bush versus Gore is.
And Jonathan Turley, Bush v. Gore, what do you expect there?
I expect to see John Roberts at his very best. You know, I do appellate work, and John has a well-deserved reputation of being an unflappable individual. And I think that you're going to see the world's greatest punt. But, you know, what I find historic about this room is everyone points out it's where Bork was heard, et cetera. To me, the most relevant historical thing about this setting is it's where the Titanic hearings were held. And, you know, the Titanic was also considered unsinkable. And so is John Roberts. He's considered unsinkable.
You see an iceberg out there? We've got 20 seconds. I don't see it.
Yeah, and so far he's not taking on any water, and it'll depend on how aggressive the Democrats are.
Well, we will just have to watch and listen and see. Jonathan Turley at George Washington University, always great having you. Thank you very much for riding along with these hearings with us this morning.
Thanks, Tom.
And Patrick Schiltz at St. Thomas, University of St. Thomas College of Law. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Here's Orrin Hatch speaking before the hearings. John Roberts, with those big blue eyes, looking on.
There is no external way to correct an error except by constitutional amendment. Now, the Supreme Court says, therefore...
And the hearings continue. In a moment, the Pentagon lays out the rules for preemptive use of nuclear weapons. This is On Point.
Now, I have here a list of... statements from Supreme Court decisions going back decades and decades to reflect this. In 1997, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor wrote for the court in Agostini v. Felton that you mentioned earlier that stare decisis or precedent is not a command, but a policy.
A head-turning new draft Pentagon doctrine envisions American military commanders using nuclear weapons to strike preemptively at a terrorist group or nation wielding weapons of mass destruction. News of the new nuclear doctrine appeared in major papers this week, but it was first revealed last May in a blog called ArmsControlWonk.com. Joining us from Washington is the publisher of that blog, Jeffrey Lewis. In his day job, he is a research fellow at the Center for International and Security Studies at the University of Maryland School of Public Policy. Jeffrey Lewis, thanks for being with us.
Oh, it's good to be with you, Tom.
Can you define what's going on here? Where is this policy in the process of becoming settled national policy, and what does it say?
Well, the policy itself is already done. What this document is simply an effort by the services, the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force, under the aegis of the Joint Staff, to explicitly say what they've already been told to do by the White House and the Secretary of Defense.
And that is?
Well, it's to plan to use nuclear weapons to prevent the use of weapons of mass destruction, and frankly, it contemplates a number of other scenarios that suggest they'd be willing to use nuclear weapons pretty much whenever they'd feel like it.
And describe some of the scenarios or the process by which that might unfold, that might happen.
Well, the document itself lays out three. The first is an adversary that intends to use weapons of mass destruction against the United States.
And this adversary could be either a nation or simply a group of terrorists.
Yeah, it simply doesn't say. It just says adversary.
Okay, and?
then there's a reference to an imminent attack where only nuclear weapons might be useful or appropriate. So that could extend beyond WMD. And then also the use of nuclear weapons to go after hardened command centers, which is rather similar to the second, and I'm not sure why they broke those out separately.
And what is the process by which an American military commander would unleash nuclear weapons, let's say, on a terrorist group somewhere, or a nation believing to have its own or to be abetting terrorists with weapons of mass destruction? How would that work? We all know the old, you know, the president carrying the football stories. If a military commander wants to do it, how does the chain of command work?
Well, the actual guidance for releasing nuclear weapons is classified, and it's thought that the president would issue that order through the chain of command, and it would go down to an individual combatant commander. One of the things that's interesting about this document is it seems to imply in at least one point that chain of command itself is under discussion. Now, I don't know that we have any evidence that they've actually considered delegating.
Meaning a commander might have battlefield leeway to use nuclear weapons.
There was a discussion about that. The paragraph is very unclear. And as I said, one of the issues is this is a public document that is designed to reflect classified thinking. And so you have to do a bit of archaeology in order to really get at the meaning.
And maybe political interpretation. Is this attempting to set up a kind of mutually assured destruction dynamic with terrorists or potential attackers saying, just as, you know, we held the Soviets at bay by promising they'd be wiped out in the case of an attack, you, dear terrorists, face the same threat?
Well, I actually think it's the opposite. You know, one of the things that we have is not just the document, which is a draft, but we also have the comments that the Army, Navy, Marines submitted. And in all of the comments, the services expressed a real desire to be more explicit about when we would use nuclear weapons and how we would use them in conjunction with conventional weapons and whether we would use them first. And in almost all of those instances, the Joint Staff's answer to them was that would be an inappropriate discussion for an unclassified document. Now, that struck me as being objectionable because, of course, I think this is an important public debate we need to be having, and it seems to me that that the Joint Staff is using classification to suppress a public debate.
Practical terms.
Sure.
Might this be contemplating then if we had Tora Bora to do over again and the government thought Osama bin Laden was somewhere in that mountain, didn't know where, could we be nuking mountains in Afghanistan next time out?
Well, you know, the document doesn't say that, but I will read you a quote that the Joint Staff put in the comments.
Quickly, if you would. We've got 40 seconds.
I think it sums it up perfectly. It says, "Where the U.S. plans to use weapons is our business. The audience reading this should only need to know that we will use them effectively." So, to me, that seems pretty open.
Be advised, sounds like the message.
Huh.
Jeffrey Lewis, publisher of the blog armscontrolwonk.com, thank you very much for being with us.
It was wonderful to talk to you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.